Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to have Susan Parker back at the Sydney Institute, this time on the occasion of the release of her most recent book, Headlong, a novel. Susan's been here before, but I should introduce her briefly. She was born in Hungary, came to Australia as a child, has worked as a teacher in film and in video, and as a lawyer, but more recently as a writer. And she spoke on her book, her award-winning book, which was translated into European languages, Hedy and Me, which also won the Christina Stead Prize in Australia, and about her novel Happy Families, but also her book which she wrote with Anne Coombs, Broome Time, about life and times in Broome. I think Susan Varga and Anne Coombs got expelled from Broome following the publication of Broome Time. They dispute that, but she hasn't been back. But she's welcome back at the Sydney Institute to talk tonight on a topic which is...
It's your title.
The Angel of Death and the Elderly. Susan Varga, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Doing what it ought to be doing?
Yes.
Okay, well, just first to say thank you to Gerard and Anne. It's very nice to be here again. It has been a bit of a tradition. When I first began writing mine, I talked about my first book here and everyone since, so it's good to have a continuous, serious forum for ideas and thinking that Anne and Gerard provide. So, the title of this talk, courtesy to Gerard, is The Angel of Death and the Elderly. He's forgotten he suggested that, but I thought, oh, well, that's pretty catchy, I'll take that. Anyway, that title got me thinking about angel. And the angel of death has a somewhat sinister connotation. It's the angel who comes to us all, the angel that will pay us one visit only, and with only one result. But angels in other contexts are benign, light-filled and magical. They're marvellous otherworldly beings who come to help and guide us. So why has this aura of light and air disappeared from around the angel of death? We know from literature and history that it has often been seen as a relief, even a deliverance from, remember that phrase, the veil of tears? For many of the world's religions, it's a welcome entry point into a better world. But in modern times, we've pushed death into the farthest reaches of our consciousness. It's as if he were the devil himself. We've lost sight not only of death's inevitability, but of its naturalness, its benign function of release and ending. And as with birth, we've medicalised almost beyond the recognition of people from other times. The dominant aim of modern doctors is to hold death at bay as long as possible and at any cost. And I mean cost. At every level. Huge monetary cost, huge emotional and physical cost. The children of elderly parents are generally willing to pay these costs, even when the actual benefit to their parents is dubious, even when the result is keeping old people alive against their will. But do we really want to make our parents suffer more than they need to in the last years of their lives? It's not what any of us would consciously wish for, but that's what we do, and we do it in four major ways. First, we throw the works at them in life prolonging procedures, regardless of what kind of life would be the result, or the pain and the suffering such procedures might inflict. Some of you may know Caroline Jones's recent book about her 90-plus-year-old dad, who unthinkingly agreed to a heart operation at that stage in his life. It caused him unbearable suffering in the recovery process, so-called recovery process. He couldn't talk, he couldn't breathe unaided, and he died a couple of months later anyway. And caused his daughter immense suffering, watching him helplessly while you should read that book, it's quite a good one. Secondly, because of the pace and style of modern life, we have often no alternative but to put our parents in less than excellent nursing homes to while away their last years bedridden, drug-addled and lonely. And because of our laws, and perhaps because of our own fear of death, we can't seriously listen to them when they say they want their life to end, nor can we help them end it. While suicide in Australia has been legal since 1983, that's over 25 years, assisting suicide is still not legal. Think about what a conundrum that is. In New South Wales, you face a maximum of 10 years jail for helping someone in a perfectly legal act. In other states and in the Northern Territory, the penalty is more severe still. To me, this speaks of how ambivalent and conflicted we are on the question of suicide. And lastly, you know, we've made it extremely hard for old people to end their lives on their own. Barbiturates, which once allowed them to die peacefully in their own beds, are no longer available. I don't think many people know that. Large quantities of sleeping pills and antidepressants usually don't work, another thing that most people, I think, don't know. An old person must be extraordinarily determined and extraordinarily courageous and savvy if they want to go at the time of their choosing. They have to be prepared to join Exit and perhaps go to a self-help workshop. Or they have to fly to Switzerland to get the help of Dignitas. Or maybe a trip to Mexico to buy Nembutal. Not only do they need enterprise and knowledge, they need money. These are mostly options for the wealthy or the middle class. Sometimes if they still have the strength and physical agility, not to mention the guts, they will resort to more terrible but effective methods. They might throw themselves out of a window, hang themselves, or sit in front of a train. My own mother, who 15 years ago sat proudly in the same room, listening to me address a similar audience on my first book, Hetty and Me, which was about her, died almost 7 years ago. She threw herself under a train. Grief-stricken and depressed after the loss of her husband, she lost all will to live. She actively began to seek death with the same determination as she'd once sought life. After several unsuccessful attempts at by more peaceful means, she connived to go in secret to the train station. Finally, she got what she most desperately desired, death. After my mother died, I felt I had an unclimbable mountain to climb. I was grief-stricken, traumatised and bewildered. I wanted only to hide and lift my wounds and wondered if the joy of life would ever return to me. But I was also a writer. I knew that while my family and I had gone through a very particular set of experiences, they were very universal too. Experiences of loss and grief, death, family conflict, difficult ethical choices. All important and fascinating and painful stuff, the stuff of life, yet areas where most people don't want to go. Who wants to read or write about old age or illness or suicide? Not sexy topics. And yet most people I knew were dealing with ageing and dying, the ageing and dying parents, and so, suddenly and confrontingly, with their own mortality. Why was no one talking about it, apart from the odd newspaper article? Why were so few people writing about it? But could I write about it? Something so raw and painful and personal? In the end, I had no choice. There was nothing else I wanted to write about. The book I'd been working on suddenly seemed worse than irrelevant. And my job as a writer, I'd always thought, was to sift experience, share it, no matter what it was, transform it, and offer any hard-won illumination to others. For me, both writing and reading arose to understanding. Without understanding, or at least trying to understand, there's not much point in life. The result was the novel I'm here to talk to you about tonight, Headlong. I decided not to make it a memoir, although the core of the story is fairly close to life. I made it a novel because I desperately needed the sliver of objectivity that fiction could give me, and I also needed the creative freedom. Without the constraints of literal truth, I thought, I had a greater chance to get at emotional truths. And given the delicacy and the taboo nature of the subject matter at many levels, fiction undeniably gave me more license. It also allowed me to bring in themes I wanted to highlight that were not there in real life. For instance, I could invent a much younger brother, living mostly overseas, who opposes his sister's handling of their mother's wish to die. That allowed me to show the clashing values between family members that so often happens in the community out there, but didn't necessarily happen, well, not quite in that way anyway, in our family. A younger brother also gave me a young, sympathetic male character that the fictional story needed. So, like many novelists, I've blended personal experience with observation, make-believe, symbol, narrative pace, etc. And if I've done my job well, the reader will never know which bits are real and which are not. That's why we writers might do many drafts, 14 in my case, to make it all look seamless. The craft is in suspending disbelief, so that you'll never know what exactly it is that makes you turn the page and read on. But by now, let me give you a little flavour of the book. This is from the very beginning of Headlong, and I'll read the first bit, even though I've got it written out here. I'll read the first bit from the book, makes me feel grounded to have the book. There was an early sign of what was happening. You became afraid of swimming. You who had always loved the water. Swimming was your meditation, your yoga. You swam a strong, smooth stroke. Remember how you taught me to swim? Breaststroke, of course. It was the only style I ever liked. It made me feel calm and secure. I have a memory of swimming towards you when I was small, reassured by the calm beauty of your working arms, the serene angle of your head. I'd swim into your arms. Little ducky, you'd say. Big ducky, I'd say, and cling to your neck. You swam into old age, still a strong, smooth stroke. After Dad died, I took to the water. It seemed to help more than anything else. I encouraged you to swim too. It's too cold now, you said. Maybe when summer comes. I found a heated pool and spa near where you lived and took you to see it. You told the receptionist all about your husband's death. She showed us the pool, which was first class. You cast a cursory glance at it. I'm afraid of the water now, you said. I don't know why. What if something were to happen to me? You'd changed, and not just temporarily, irrevocably. And this is a little later. I better stick to my script, otherwise I'll lose my place. This is a little later when Garbor, Julia's husband, suffers a stroke. The stroke fell Dad in the afternoon. The news didn't reach me till 7 o'clock that night. Jill and I drove to Sydney at speed. At the hospital, I ran down the long linoleum corridors trying to find the tiny emergency room they'd parked him in. The room was lit with a malevolent yellow light. It smelt of too many people and disinfectant. Speak to him, Cotty, Mum said as soon as she saw me. Say something to him. Hold his hand. Touch him. I took his hand, which was warm and damp. I'm here, Dad, I said. Eat by your sat out there. I love you. He can hear you, Julia said. Talk to him. I'm here, Dad. I came straight away. I love you. I'm here, Dad. I couldn't think of anything else to say. He looked at me with his one good eye. He still had the use of one arm and one eye. The eye looked angry, bewildered. He raised the arm and beat it back down on bed in a gesture of frustration. The arm swung up again, then down, with surprising force. "Ear das Yorkish off arm, my dear good little father," Mum said, and stroked his hand and carved his arm. "Tell him to squeeze your hand to show you he knows you." He squeezed my hand once, twice. "Good Dad, wonderful Dad, indeed. I was inordinately, hysterically pleased. You're doing very well. Squeeze my hand again." "Ear das Yorkish off arm, my dear good little father, my dear good little father," Julia keened, as she would hundreds of times in the next 36 hours. She didn't say much else to him. That one little phrase held everything. "Oh, what has happened to us? How terribly I will miss you. How much I love you. You've been a good husband. Yes, you are dying. I cannot deny it. How I suffer for you. how terrible my life would be without you. And so it went for many hours, the beating of his arm becoming less, his eyes beginning to film, until he slipped quietly into unconsciousness. We held his hand and stroked him throughout. I don't think I touched him so much in my whole life. Another reason I decided to write Headlong is that, being born at the end of 1943, admitting my age is public here, I just perceived the baby boomer generation. And I hope that this book and its themes will speak to that generation. The baby boomers, now teetering on the outer reaches of middle age, have sought greater freedom and self-determination than any other generation before them. Now they're going through the aging and death of their parents. They're also beginning to face the extraordinary fact that they too will die. From what we know of them, they will not go passively into inadequate nursing homes and wait patiently for death. The whole tenor of their lives has been otherwise. They want a better deal, and they're beginning to agitate for it. The membership of euthanasia societies in Exit International is not just made up of the very old or the terminally ill. There's also ordinary middle-class people who have witnessed the painful and lingering death or a forced suicide of a loved one, and they're not prepared to countenance loss of control and helplessness at the end of their own lives. Now, as these baby boomers begin to agitate for change, and a lot of them have good political skills and clout, it will make a very interesting time for the politicians. So far, with the one exception of the short-lived euthanasia legislation in the Northern Territory, there's no movement on this issue. Each pro-euthanasia bill put up since has failed. And yet consistently, in Australia and in other countries, about 75 to 80% of the population favours euthanasia. That's been so for many years now. Few other countries, there's Holland, Belgium, Switzerland, some South American countries, Oregon, I'm not entirely sure about Maine in the USA, but I think it's Oregon and Maine, have passed Seattle. Euthanasia. Sorry?
Seattle,
thank you. I knew someone would know. They've passed euthanasia legislation with no perceptible increase in the number of elderly dying. Most people just want to know they can do something if need be. Usually that knowledge calms them and makes them more positive. And in the end, they rarely take matters into their own hands. Yet in this country, the politicians refuse to touch the issue. Why is that? Fear of the religious right? Fear of controversy? In the too hard basket? I think it's all of the above, combined with this modern world's underlying horror of death and fear even of talking about it. It all makes for a very powerful taboo. You look at the attempt, for instance, to silence Philip Nitschke and Dr. Fiona Stewart for trying to convey their thoughts either by telephone or online about possible peaceful death to thousands who are looking to them for help. But there's a $10,000 fine for online communications, and their book, called The Peaceful Pill, is banned. It seems to me that euthanasia and suicide are still hush-hush, lace-curtain territory, don't talk about it. It's like incest and child abuse once were, and even until pretty recently, depression. Every now and again it hits the papers. We hear the desperate cry of an aged couple who decided to go together, or an agonised wife or husband who has the courage to help a suffering spouse. The debate flares, people take sides, and then it all dies down until the next time. But I predict that euthanasia and suicide and assisted suicide will become the next topics to come out of the closet. And not before time. We need to start talking, thinking and feeling. Especially feeling. The welfare of the very old and the very ill are at stake. Our old and ill. And this is an ageing population, we must remember. Now, there's a lot of argument and polemic in this area. Do you remember the debate raging around the elderly academic Lisette Nijot, I think it's how her name's pronounced, killed herself at 80 simply because she said it was time. She wasn't depressed, she wasn't ill, she said it was time. So there's lots of argument, but there's not much fiction. Fiction deals with people and emotions, and it deals especially in empathy. Headlong doesn't take a stand on euthanasia or suicide. That's an asthma for a novel. You'd never do that if you're a decent novelist. but it does try to take you to the heart of the situation and ask you to feel for both the daughter Cotty and the mother Julia, and to ask, if it was me, if I were in this situation, what would I do? My strong belief is that people only change their position on something if they've been touched in their hearts and souls, as well as their minds. Literature is a powerful medium. That's how we examine ourselves and our choices. It's a very powerful way of doing it anyway. We grow to love or hate the characters in a novel. We care what will happen to them. And we're invited to witness intimately situations that are new to us. And yet, as we read on, so close and so familiar. As perhaps this passage I'm going to read to you next. Julia has made her first suicide attempt. When Julia wakes up in hospital, she is very angry that she's still alive. She is furious. I can't believe I'm still here. This is the worst nightmare. I wanted so much to go. Let me go. You must help me. Help me. She clutches my hand, looks compulsively at my sleeve. Help me. Shh, Edesham, dearest, shh. You'll be all right. No. Never. I want to die. Her eyes lock on mine. She retains my hand in a feverish grasp. Cotty, it's all I want. Mum, please, you don't know what you're saying. Yes, I do. Don't pretend to be a fool. Promise me you'll help me. Promise me solemnly. I know I can't. You know I can't. You must. Help my mother die? It's out of the question. She's just old, ill, grieving. Time and love and care are all she needs. Mum, I say, remember the war years and since? You've never admitted defeat before. Never. Why now? This is different, she says, and turns her head away from me. Interestingly, I noticed when I was finishing Headlong, and as it was being published, that I was part of the zeitgeist. It's often when you're writing a book, you think you're all on your own, and then other voices chime in. Other writers were beginning to touch on previously taboo, won't sell sort of topics. There's been Garner's The Spare Room, about a friend dying of cancer. Gabriel Carey's memoir about her mother's illness. Some of you may have been to her talk. I think she was here recently. Caroline Jones, as I mentioned, on the death of her beloved father. But I think that Headlong takes us one step further in asking two deep and deeply important questions. When, if at any point, are you allowed to say that life is not worth living? And it also asks, if someone you truly love does not want to live anymore and is clearly not insane, what is your true filial duty? Do you have a duty as a son or daughter to keep them alive at all cost? Or is your duty to listen to that deep desire and help in its achievement? Again, there are no answers, just the experience of one family and how they negotiated this emotional, moral and legal minefield. Now, some people have said to me that Headlong reads like a raw diary, like unmediated experience, and my answer to that is it's meant to. I wanted to capture how these terrible dilemmas come upon us headlong, when there's no time to think rationally and behave perfectly and have your moral position all worked out. That's not how life works. I wanted to retain the pain and confusion that illness, grief and death bring. Polemics and politics play no real part when it comes to the crunch. You're flying by the seat of your pants, which is why some of our more thoughtful citizens join euthanasia societies and lobby for change, or the more feisty of them join self-help exit groups make their own pills. They've thought ahead. They want to be prepared. Another theme in Headlong is that I set it around the time of September 11 and the refugee crisis induced by the Tampa sailing into Australian waters. I wanted this as a sort of sub-theme, not only because of my own involvement in those issues, but I wanted to explore that uneasy interplay that can happen between our public life, you know, when we're pursuing careers and politics and causes, and then the personal and intimate tragedies happen to us and engulf us. So even though Julia herself has been a refugee fleeing Hitler, ironically, she's resentful of Cotty's involvement in the refugee issue. She thinks all of her daughter's attention should be centred on her and her flight from life. But Cotty's refugee work gives her some other perspective. As she says, she feels the need to cling to the wider world so as not to drown in my own small one. It's another tension, many tensions that happen in these last months between mother and daughter. Of course, Cotty's first reaction when her mother talks of wanting to die is a natural and ordinary one. Can't be countenanced. But as it becomes clear that Julia won't change and that she'll try again and again until she succeeds, Cotty is forced to re-examine. And I'll read a little from the book again. For a couple of weeks after returning home, she does not talk about dying. But as the pattern of illness resumes, she begins again. Almost every day she says, I want to go, Cotty. This is no life. You have to help me. I can't do it on my own. I've tried. Promise me you'll help me. I know my mother. She loves a bit of drama, but she doesn't bullshit in matters of life or death. When it comes to the purest questions, she's a straight thinker. It's yes or no, and she sticks to her decisions. She has never been at, she has never ever broached suicide before in her long life. She has never been a depressive. So I know she's serious, utterly so. It follows that I have to take her seriously and consider seriously my duties to her. What am I to do? I know that what I'm facing here is not unusual. Around the country, around the world, every day, the old and ill asking those close to them to help them die. What does a daughter, a son, a husband, a dear friend do? What am I to do? Much later, after Julie has died, when Cotty begins to think and read and go over what has happened, she tries to get the whole suicide question into some perspective. Why do we so fear and adore it? Can it be a legitimate option, at least for some, and in some circumstances? And this is one of the things she thinks. Suicide is a form of political insubordination. That has echoes for me and for my times. To say, life is not worth living, I don't value it as the rest of you do, is the most subversive statement anyone can make. Followed by a willed removal of the self, it's a devastating rejection of those left behind. I think of Camus' famous dictum, there's but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that's suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental questions of philosophy. I suspect the temptation of suicide is universal and powerful. It can tempt anyone at any time as the logical answer to life's unbearable difficulty. It's just that for most people, the temptation lasts for an instant or an hour, but for a few of us, it's so powerful that it eclipses the world. Your mother was terribly depressed, a friend of Julia said to me yesterday, implying that irrational depression was the only possible explanation for her death. True, I said, but she was also very consistent and logical about wanting to die. I was trying to explain that Julia reasoned herself into her death. She was in the grip of an unanswerable internal logic, a kind of suicidal vision. Suicides don't give way to a blank despair that deprives them of all powers of thought. Death makes profound sense to them. Life's meaninglessness has finally found its logical solution. It's the depressives, not the suicides, who may be the more truly unhappy because they see no way out. They're mired in inaction, whereas the suicide has found something that they can do. And here's another mystery at the heart of Headlong. Some of you may have read Head in Me, my first book, and will know that my mother was a kind of heroine. In the war years in Hungary, she fought like a tiger to protect her small daughters, then battled to survive on her own after her husband's death in a labour camp. Post-war, she came to Australia with a new husband. He lost his first wife and two little sons in the Holocaust. And together, with this new blended family, they forged a new and successful life. My mother, Hedy, was a positive, unsubtle life force, a real doer. She was the last person anyone would have thought would commit suicide. Yet Cotty comes to see that Julia, who's frankly modelled on Hedy, has in the end been defeated by the accumulated traumas of her life. She's never had time to grieve, never indulged in introspection, never come to terms with her losses. Once her husband dies, and she's old, she's really old, in her mid-80s, she no longer wants to keep fighting. Life no longer interests her. Was she within her rights to say, enough, I want to go? Not all people who attempt suicide are necessarily mentally ill. I think this is a huge trend in our modern society, that anyone who might want to die must be crazy. Perhaps there's such a thing as a right to die. And surely there's such a thing as genuine and overwhelming grief or sadness. I query, really, whether it should be medicalised as depression with a capital D. That's a whole other topic that we don't have time for today, but it's a big one. But as I wrote in Headlong, I hate that slippery word of depression. It was just called sadness once. It can look suspiciously like grief, too. Depression, sadness, grief, they're as close as sisters. And when does the common or garden depression slip into the clinical variety? How do you grasp that someone you thought you knew has slipped beyond the reach of love and reason? There's no foreign madness associated with either sort of depression. How are you meant to know? I think you know that psychic pain can be as legitimate as a reason to want to die as physical pain. And it's interesting that one Dutch study done a few years ago, fully 62% of the respondents